We present Jill Bevilacqua's program, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Let's listen.
Jesus entered a village where a woman named Martha welcomed him to her home. She had a sister named Mary, who seated herself at the Lord's feet and listened to his words. Martha, who was busy with all the details of hospitality, came to him and said, "Lord, are you not concerned that my sister has left me all alone to do the household tasks? Tell her to help me." The Lord, in reply, said to her, "Martha, Martha, you are anxious and upset about many things. One thing only is required. Mary has chosen the better portion, and she shall not be deprived of it."
No mention is made of its name, only a village, but a village which is dear to every Christian because it was dear to Christ. Bethany, or as today's guidebook writes, Al-Azariyeh, an Arabic version of the name of Lazarus, the most famous inhabitant of the village. Today's gospel is not concerned with Lazarus, but with his sisters, Martha and Mary, in a celebrated episode, frequently quoted for the unexpected answer Jesus gives to Martha. It's autumn, probably sometime in October, and the Feast of Tabernacles is imminent. Last week we heard the parable of the Good Samaritan and the account of a traveller's journey down the desert road from Jerusalem to Jericho. Jesus and the disciples are travelling in the opposite direction, up towards Jerusalem. And as we read in other versions of today's gospel, in the course of their journey he came to a village. The village was Bethany. It is, we read in the guidebook,
a village on the lower eastern slope of the Mount of Olives, nigh unto Jerusalem, about 15 furlongs off, quoting an old version of John, on the Jerusalem-Jericho road. The name Bethany derives from the Greek form of the Hebrew Beth Ananiah, the house of a person named Ananiah, or the shortened version Bethaniah. The site does not seem to have been inhabited prior to the 6th century BC. From that time on, Bethany has been continuously settled and was, as it is now, the last stop on the Jericho road before entering Jerusalem.
When H.V. Morton drove down that road from Jerusalem, he noted that the first sign of life was a well, known as the Fountain of the Apostles. But he mentioned something else.
On my right, a narrow footpath ran back through the hills to Jerusalem. This was the ancient shortcut to Bethany, and the road that Jesus and his disciples would have taken when they went up to the Passover and the Last Supper.
The Jericho road also sends a branch road right up over the crest of the Mount of Olives to Bethphage and Bethany. And on another occasion, our traveller walked this road with, as he writes, the sun beating on it and the heat quivering like white fire on the rocks. Which road did Jesus and the disciples take, I wonder? Did they know the shortcut? Did they already know Martha and Mary? And where did the disciples stay while Jesus was there? It seems they would have had no problem in finding lodgings, for according to the Talmud, Bethany and its neighbour Bethphage were specially noted for their hospitality to pilgrims. On this occasion, when the Feast of Tabernacles was so near, pilgrims would already be converging on Jerusalem, so the two villages would be in readiness for the expected influx. Bethphage seems to have disappeared from the map, for the guidebook tells us that the name now applies to a Franciscan church, built next to the very steep road that descends from the Mount of Olives eastwards towards the village of El Azariah, ancient Bethany, and the Jerusalem-Jericho highway. But we will remember Bethphage for the errand on which Jesus sent two disciples, as Matthew recounts.
When they were near Jerusalem, and had come in sight of Bethphage on the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village facing you, and you will immediately find a tethered donkey and a colt with her. Untie them and bring them to me."
Mark adds that the tethered colt had not yet been ridden by anyone. An invisible reserved was on its back. We are not in Bethphage, however, but in Bethany, and there's an atmosphere of festivity in the village on the little hill. The Feast of Tabernacles was one of the three so-called pilgrim or foot festivals, because pilgrims travel to Jerusalem to celebrate them in the temple. All three have in common the theme of joy in God's presence, writes modern Jewish scholar Norman Solomon.
The festive joy is traditionally expressed in feasting with meat and drink, and with the purchase of new garments for the women. It's a joy which is only complete when allied with concern for the needy. Each of the festivals has a historical, a spiritual, and an agricultural meaning.
So writes Solomon, and in a table explains these: Sukkot, Tabernacles, Autumn. The historical meaning: God protected the Israelites in the desert, and he quotes Leviticus.
So that your generations should know that I made the Israelites dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt.
The spiritual meaning: God is our protector. This is symbolised as we leave our homes and dwell in simple booths, Sukkot. The agricultural meaning: the final harvest festival of the year. A manual on daily life in Bible times goes into more detail about the festival, known also as the Feast of Booths, because the Israelites lived in tents or arbours during the celebration.
The festival began on the 15th day of the 7th month, Tishri, and lasted for 7 days. It fell at the end of the harvest season, thus a third name for the festival, the Feast of Ingathering. The priests offered a special burnt offering of 70 bullocks during the week. 2 rams and 14 lambs were the daily burnt offering, and a male goat the daily sin offering. Every 7th year, when there was no harvest because of the sabbatical year, the law of Moses was read publicly during the feast.
We don't know if the women went up to the temple for the feast, but as the manual explains,
all males were required to appear before the sanctuary of the Lord during Israel's great pilgrim feasts.
And we don't know whether Jesus and the apostles participated in all of the Jewish rituals and feasts. Jesus loved the temple and respected it. He supported it by encouraging his followers to attend it. Yet Jesus said that in this place is one greater than the temple, referring to himself. In John's Gospel, we read that as the Feast of Tabernacles drew near, his relations urged Jesus to leave Galilee and go to Judea, so that his disciples there could see the works he was doing. But Jesus answered them,
"The right time for me has not come yet, but any time is the right time for you. Go up to the festival yourselves. I'm not going to this festival because for me the time is not ripe yet." Having said that, he stayed behind in Galilee.
As we are following Luke's Gospel, we know that Jesus did indeed leave Galilee and go towards Jerusalem. And John goes on,
"However, after his brothers had left for the festival, he went up as well, but quite privately, without drawing attention to himself. At the festival, the Jews were on the lookout for him. 'Where is he?' they said. When the festival was half over, Jesus went to the temple and began to teach."
So it sounds as if the journey to Jerusalem Jesus made was with the apostles and close disciples, but that he preferred to let his relations go on ahead, to avoid the clamour they seem so often to have roused with their criticisms of his behaviour. And so here he is, sitting quietly in Bethany, having left his companions to go over to Jerusalem, a couple of miles away, to fulfil their temple duties. Perhaps Lazarus is with them. His sisters, however, are at home. And as Norman Solomon comments, festival celebrations are as much a matter for the home as for the synagogue. Solomon is writing today, when the temple is no more and the synagogue is the centre of Jewish worship. Let's hear how H.V. Morton imagines the scene at Bethany that day so long ago.
"Sitting on the little hill above Bethany, I could visualise the scene. The house with the smell of cooking around it for the Feast of Tabernacles, at which this incident occurred, was a busy time for Jewish women. And the little arbour of green leaves, the tabernacle of the feast, beneath which Jesus would be sitting in the courtyard with Mary at his feet. They would both be able to see and hear Martha, busy with her pots and pans, and she would see Jesus and Mary so cool and idle while she was so busy. How well her irritation is conveyed by the fact that she includes Jesus in her rebuke. Lord, do you not care that my sister is leaving me to do all the serving by myself? Please tell her to help me. She might have said, Lord, see how my sister is leaving me to serve alone. But she is too angry. If they'd been invisible from her kitchen, she might not have been so angry. She would not have seen her sister so cool and tidy, so calm and so intelligent. But Jesus and Mary were sitting in the courtyard, in a leafy summer house of fresh boughs, the peace that surrounded them and the shade in which they sat, throwing into relief her own labours, quickening her self-pity and her sense of injustice. As Martha stands before Jesus, we know her so well. She is immortal and international. In every language under the sun and in every age, Martha has broken into a discussion with an indignant, "You sit there doing nothing while I'm working my fingers to the bone." And the reply she receives from the arbor is enough to bring tears to her eyes. "Martha," says Jesus, mentioning her name twice, and thus putting great affection into what followed. "Martha, Martha, you worry and fret about so many things, and yet few are needed, indeed only one. It is Mary who's chosen the better part. It's not to be taken from her."
Luke's account ends here, a mere 100 words, but so dense with meaning that no more words are needed. Silence is the only possible sequel. And silence is what one imagines followed those words of our Lord. What did Martha do? Standing at the kitchen door, holding one of those pots or pans, she puts it down and throws herself at the feet of the Master. Behind her, a bubbling or sizzling warns her that she must go and see that nothing is burning. But she takes no notice. If it burns, what does it matter? Nothing matters but to be with him.